The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Donald Trump's candidacy, conduct, and communication style are historically unprecedented. So the announcement that his wife, Melania, will not move directly into the White House after inauguration, and that his daughter, Ivanka, will have an office there, and that family members may sit in on cabinet meetings was not entirely surprising, and as it turns out, not unparalleled. Brady Carlson is Word of Mouth's presidential historian and author of Dead Presidents, joining us now from Wisconsin Public Radio to talk about presidential kids past who've worked in the White House. Brady, great to have you back.
Happy New Year, Virginia.
Well, Happy New Year to you. Of course, our democracy was based on this idea of rejecting power based on lineage. So did the framers address familial roles?
Well, they did it mostly through custom. I mean, they certainly were trying to avoid any comparisons to a monarchy, but because they were turning to the man who had the most civic virtue of anyone, George Washington, to be the first president of the United States, they left it up to him, saying he's going to have enough propriety to keep things on the up and up. George Washington, in fact, once considered adding a line to, I think it was his inaugural address, pointing out that he had no one to bequeath his job to since he had no children. He decided in the end maybe that wasn't the manliest phrase he could put into his speech, so he left it out. But it was this idea that he needed to make it clear that this was a job that was entrusted to a person, not something that a person could hand down. That said, we have had plenty of powerful political families in the United States. We've had the Bushes, the Tafts, the Roosevelts, the Clintons, and some of those families have put more than one of their members in or close to the White House.
Has there ever, though, been a law against nepotism?
Yes. In fact, there's one on the books now. It says, and I'll just quote it, a public official may not appoint, employ, promote, advance, or advocate for appointment, employment, promotion, or advancement in or to a civilian position in the agency in which he is serving or over which he exercises jurisdiction or control any individual who is a relative of the public official. And it specifies that the president is one of those officials who's not supposed to appoint relatives to any position that he or she controls. Now, some scholars point out that the Constitution outlines the president's powers to appoint, and that might actually trump the federal law. That was passed in 1967, and the story that's always been told about it was that it was passed in the aftermath of John F. Kennedy's assassination to keep out, say, his brother, Bobby Kennedy, who had served as his attorney general, and the then president at the time, Lyndon Johnson, didn't exactly get along with Bobby Kennedy. So it was kind of a way to twist the knife in their long-running feud.
Well, that was a brother, Bobby Kennedy and JFK. But how about kids? Are there kids who have worked for their father, since, of course, it was always fathers?
Yes. The most prominent example would be John Quincy Adams. He was one of John Adams' sons, and he had been promising to the point that when John Adams would travel for the many positions he held in the early days of the United States, that he would bring John Quincy along with him. Later, after he had studied at Harvard and sort of grown up, President George Washington named John Quincy Adams minister to the Netherlands at the time that his father, John Adams, was serving as vice president. Now, that in and of itself doesn't suggest nepotism necessarily, but John Adams did, when he was elected president, sent his son to represent the U.S. in Prussia. So he did give his son a government job. To be fair, John Quincy Adams was highly qualified and was an extremely talented diplomat. He would then go on to serve as Secretary of State and would later be elected president himself. In fact, one of the most qualified, if not the most qualified person ever elected president. There have been other examples over the years. Most of the time when a president's son or daughter works for a president, it's in a role of kind of like a private secretary or an aide, not necessarily an official job title. One example is President Rutherford B. Hayes' son, Webb, who was his father's private secretary in the White House. He would go on to become kind of an amazing an unheralded American figure. He was a prominent businessman and then decided to give all of that up to become a soldier, and had become kind of, his exploits are kind of fun and kind of wild to read about. Imagine a CEO leaving the boardroom and then becoming kind of a soldier of fortune, almost an Indiana Jones type. He would go on to win the Medal of Honor and have some really thrilling exploits. Then after he retired, he went on to build a presidential library. It was the first public presidential library.
Okay, so that's Webb Hayes, Rutherford B. Hayes' son. Have there been others like John Quincy Adams, who of course became president, who went on to other government roles?
Yeah, I would say the most prominent example of that is not necessarily a government role, but a military role. Theodore Roosevelt Jr. Imagine being Theodore Roosevelt Jr., right? I mean, that, in fact, he would speak oftentimes about, there's no way that a person in my position could ever live up to his name with a father like Theodore Roosevelt. But he did give it a great try. He was in the military. He fought in a number of wars and ended up as a brigadier general in World War II. In fact, he was the first general to land during D-Day. He was on Utah Beach. Is this 57-year-old man standing there on the beach, directing troops with his cane and really rallying people to move toward the German positions. The thing is, he was literally having a heart attack at the time and wound up dying about a month later. Omar Bradley, who is another famous World War II general, was asked, what was the most heroic thing you saw in the war? And he answered immediately, he said, Theodore Roosevelt at Utah Beach.
Wow. We've talked so far about sons, but there have been some particularly strong bonds between presidents and daughters, some even serving almost in a first lady-like capacity, as it's suspected Ivanka Trump might.
Just by way of context, it's not necessarily strange for someone other than the president's wife to serve as first lady. I mean, an example of that goes back to when Thomas Jefferson was president. His wife had died years before he was elected. So his daughter would sometimes serve as the social hostess of the White House. Sometimes his friend James Madison's wife, Dolly, who became the model for the position that eventually became called First Lady, would fill in and serve that. And a number of presidents had been in similar situations. So it's not necessarily an unusual thing, though it is less usual in modern times. Really, since Eleanor Roosevelt, the job of First Lady has been more formalized. The First Lady has her own staff and things like that. But really, like anything else surrounding the president, the role of what it's like to be a presidential family member is something we've been sorting out over time. A great example of a daughter who was influential or played an important role in a presidency was Franklin Roosevelt's daughter, Anna. Now, Franklin Roosevelt had Eleanor Roosevelt as his first lady, and she was off traveling the country and really had her own career, her own sphere of influence. But inside the White House, Anna Roosevelt was often seen as the go-to person. If you needed to get to the president, she was the intermediary. She didn't have a formal role. She wasn't the president's secretary or an aide or anything like that. She was really just off the books in a way. But in the last few years of his presidency, she was as involved in his day-to-day affairs as pretty much anyone else.
We're talking with Brady Carlson. He's author of the book Dead Presidents and our, let's say, presidential historian. We're talking about some of the roles that first family members have played historically in other presidencies. Brady, we're talking about some family members, sons, daughters, who have served their fathers during their presidency. Others who have not had such a cozy relationship with dad in the White House?
Yeah, others have had a hard time figuring out if my dad is the president. You know, that's sort of like having a supernova in your life, this immense figure who is the center of attention everywhere he goes. And how do you develop your own identity when you've got that in your life? In recent years, some of Ronald Reagan's children were growing up in public, so to speak, and would sometimes say oppose their own father's policies in the news while he was in office. Some of Ronald Reagan's kids were growing up in public in a way when he was president and were sometimes, say, publicly at odds with his positions while he was president. And then George H.W. Bush, who was Reagan's successor, the government sued his son Neil and Neil's company during the savings and loan crisis. That was while Bush was president. He said as a father, it was difficult, but as a president, it wasn't something he was going to be involved with because he was going to steer clear of that. But you have to think that was pretty awkward.
Right. Do you have a favorite presidential spawn?
It has to be Alice Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt's oldest daughter, who
so
was...
So glad you said that. I've read about her. She just sounds like quite a character.
Well, I mean, this comes back to that idea of how do you become yourself when you've got a president for a father? And Alice succeeded beyond anyone's expectation. She just said, I'm going to do what I want. I mean, all of the Roosevelt kids were pretty wild. They were running all over the place and were bringing exotic pets into the White House. Alice had a snake. That was her contribution. But she would smoke on the roof of the White House and she would liven up parties. If she thought things were getting kind of dull, she would just fire a pistol into the air to wake people up. And after the Roosevelts left the White House, she stayed in Washington, D.C. She had married a prominent politician at the time and became sort of the go-to political slash social figure for decades. She cultivated presidents and famous politicians and famous people and became just sort of a quotable person. There was a funny moment once where Lyndon Johnson came to see her and in her later years, Alice Roosevelt would wear this big hat and Johnson, who was president at the time, said, you know, when you're wearing that hat, Alice, it makes it hard for me to give you a kiss. She goes, Mr. President, why do you think I wear it? Her famous saying, of course, she loved political gossip, and her famous saying was, if you don't have anything nice to say about someone, sit right here by me. That's sort of the most famous Alice quote. And she lived into her 90s and had, even by American political standards, an incredibly unique life.
So though she was unique, it is not so singular for the child of a president to serve close to him. But I really can't help but wonder what the framers would think of someone called Barron living in the White House.
It is such an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, the presidency itself has changed in so many ways from what was originally envisioned by the framers. They really thought of it as a sort of a CEO job. That was the person who's going to implement things that the really powerful people, Congress, did. And it wasn't necessarily going to be the fixture of American political life that it has become. And not just in political terms either. I mean, the president is a cultural figure as much as he is a political figure. There's so much then that comes with that. I mean, you have exhibits at the Smithsonian about the dresses that the wives of presidents wear, and you have books written about what the children of presidents do, not necessarily because they're doing anything that the rest of us don't do, but because their dad is the president. And so that becomes a component of our cultural life in a really interesting way. But I think to the broader question, since Barron can mean multiple things, what about having a real estate Barron as the next president? And that's going to be an interesting question. You know, the people who don't like the president-elect say that he's a demagogue and that the framers tried to build a system to block demagogues from becoming president. Then again, a lot of people can point to the new president's wealth and say, well, George Washington was the first president and at the time was probably the richest or close to the richest man in America. So look, our political system is full of surprises and it's going to be interesting to see how this surprise plays out.
It is indeed. And Brady, we'll keep turning to you. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Brady Carlson, he is a host and reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio and author of Dead Presidents, an American adventure into the strange deaths and surprising afterlives of our nation's leaders. Much more on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The characters in Robin MacArthur's stories live in a slice of Vermont where mobile homes molder and barns sink into the sod, where the abandoned fields of burned-out dairy farms sit alongside swanky second homes. There, hollowed-out hippies and solitary loggers cling to their land, and over the 40 years covered in her new collection, they and their children resign themselves to waiting out the days or dream of leaving.
Are you still lonesome? Are you still handsome? Are
Wild is the debut story collection by Robin MacArthur. She lives in Marlborough, Vermont, where she and her husband make music as Red Heart the Ticker. You're listening to a bit from the duo's album, Tigers of the New England Forest. I spoke with Robin last summer when the album and the book first came out. It's a collection of linked stories with landmarks like Whiskey Mountain, the Indian Love Call swimming hole, and the smoke-filled Stonewall Tavern running throughout. I asked her if she originally conceived of the stories as connected.
I wrote them as not that. I knew that they were all set in southern Vermont, where I live, where I've spent most of my life. It was at the very end that I decided to make them more explicitly linked. And I didn't want to have them become the same characters, but I wanted the landscape to link them. So
yes.
The creeks and the mountains and the roads.
That's a reliable character.
It is.
But we do see this place over a 50-year span, and we do meet or hear about generations of people with the same last names, know each other, maybe they dated in school, all connected to people who used to eke out a living logging or selling cordwood or milking cows or sugaring. How do the people make a living now?
It's really a hodgepodge, I would say. Most people who I know, it's kind of a crazy quilt of careers. There's a lot of second home building. You know, my dad has spent his life building homes for people, second homes and first homes. And there's a nuclear power plant. There's a hospital. But a lot of people work as gardeners, house cleaners, nailing up sheetrock and working on farms.
Yeah, so this is the
piecing it together.
The new rural experience,
mm-hmm.
I think.
It is.
Well, some leave or dream of it, or some are brought back by circumstance. And there's the woman named Hannah. She's in a story called The Women Where I'm From. Bolts to Seattle, returns when her mother has breast cancer. I wonder if you could read a little bit.
Sure, I'd love to.
Can you set up the scene for us?
Yeah, so Hannah has returned back. Her mother has breast cancer. Her mother is a hippie, is living in this dilapidated house that was once a commune. And Hannah has met up with her old friend from high school who never left and is trying to describe to her friend, or a friend asks her, what's it like out west where you live? It's good, badass and good. I can't wait to hear all about it, Christy says. Yeah, I say, sometime, though I wonder how I'll sum it up to this friend who has never lived anywhere but here. The vegan strip clubs popping up in my neighborhood, Matthew's unpeopled and pristine landscapes full of romanticism and yearning. When we were 12, Christy's dad, Trevor, killed himself by jumping off an interstate bridge into the shallow waters of Silver Creek. I spent that night on the floor next to her bed. Our lives were once as entwined as fence post and honeysuckle. Now she still lives with her mom, Annie, down the hill from my mother's farm, in a blue double-wide and tens bar, and has never left this town, a stone's throw from Boston or New York or numerous other places she could have fled to for any substantial amount of time. What is it, this tether?
Well, so Hannah's a divided soul, and there are some divided souls here. They're connected to this place in a really deep way, but yet they just had to get out.
Mm-hmm. So that's a theme throughout the book, for sure, and it definitely comes from my own push and pull towards and away from home. You know, I grew up on the piece of land where my dad also grew up. It was a house deep in the woods, off-grid. The only houses that we could walk to were extended family. And I was sure when I was young that I would leave and I would go live in New York and I would never return. And it turns out that I did go live in New York and I couldn't not return on a regular basis. I built a cabin in the woods and I would head back as often as I could. And so I know that tether well, and I definitely felt like part of the inspiration to write this book was an exploration of that pull towards home, that desire to live new lives elsewhere, and also an unwillingness to, or inability to really feel complete without those tethers and those roots.
This reminded me also of a song from your new record. Let's hear a little bit from Peaches and Plums.
Our road's grown up in trees. The piano's all out of key. It's a dream of the city, but the country's so pretty. Banging on pans and cymbals, yeah, the stars pour out.
That's the song Peaches and Plums from the new album by Red Heart the Ticker. And my guest, Robin MacArthur, and her husband's band is Red Heart the Ticker. In addition to their new album, she's got a new book out called Half Wild. So that little piece of song, you know, it's an imperfect life here, and mm-hmm. we're dreaming of someplace else. These characters in the book feel confined, even if they're surrounded by beauty or half wildness, I guess. Mm-hmm. How connected are the themes in the music on the new album and the book?
You know, they're not intentionally connected, but I would say that Tyler and I, we live in this cabin that we built in the woods. We have two kids. Our creative bubble is pretty small, and it's pretty much just the two of us. So he will write a song, and I'm the only person who hears that song, and it feeds my stories. And I write stories, and he reads those stories, and it feeds his songs. So I was listening to the album on my way here in the car, and I kept noticing lines that were connected that I'd never even noticed before. So it was definitely not an intentional thing, but it felt right to release them at the same time because they are definitely of the same landscape and contain the same yearning and the same, you know, that's a kind of haunted attachment to place and desire to be elsewhere. And yet here we are. Yeah. We are in these woods.
And the woods, the trees, the birds, the wild animals, the mm-hmm. real and the mythical wild animals are such a part of the character here. Although there was a young woman who mocks that, you know, the Southerners and Japanese tourists who come by the busload every year to take pictures of full-colored splendor, not a splendor she necessarily sees. They don't see those hollowed-out lives in these woods. How did you get this close view?
Mm-hmm. Well, my dad grew up in my town, and he's a house builder. My mother's a farmer and a school bus driver. So I feel like I had access through my parents to an entire other generation of Vermont dwellers. They were, even though my dad grew up here, they were definitely part of the homesteading movement. 30,000 hippies and homesteaders moved to Vermont in the late 60s and early 70s. And so that's definitely changed our cultural makeup dramatically and drastically. But these people who have been here for more generations than that are still definitely in these towns and kind of quietly living at the edges and are less seen. And I wanted to give them voices. Mm. And my dad used to take me driving around as I was a kid, like so many of the characters in the book do, and just point out what land used to belong to who and who used to own what houses and why they had to sell them and how much they sold, you know, dirt cheap, selling them at farm auctions to second homeowners. And so I grew up with just a deep kind of awareness of the passage of time in this place and what had happened and shifted culturally.
Many of the characters are women living alone in their houses, some widows of the stoic, alcoholic, sometimes abusive husbands, a few aging hippies who've been in the thrall of a series of unreliable boyfriends. And I wonder, what's the pull for you, like women mm-hmm. living out in the woods, mm-hmm. as a woman you living know, out in the woods?
As a woman who lives out in the woods. You know, my mother is not the mother in any of these stories, but she is a very intrepid woman who is drawn to the woods. She rides a motorcycle. She knows how to wield a shotgun. She farms. She spends 14 hours a day out in her fields. And I grew up surrounded by women like that, and I never saw them depicted in fiction, that kind of tough loneliness, intrepid, but choosing loneliness, choosing the woods, choosing this connection with nature and with a wilder landscape. And I always pined for that kind of woman in fiction. And so I finally decided that I just had to write them myself.
And some of them are, there are some lines here that are fascinating about, you know, a mother's love and being in love with their mothers when they were growing up. But then something shifts. Mm-hmm. You know? A lot of times it comes at about 16. Mm-hmm. There seemed to be a lot of 16. Was that a transformative age for Robin MacArthur?
When I was 16, I moved out of my parents' house and I moved into a cabin that I built in the woods.
Wow.
So yes, that is a transformative age. And I have a daughter who is almost 8, and I'm just terrified of what will happen when she turns 16. And how she will feel about her mother.
Well, because we do live in this age of social media, we get a picture of your house in Marlboro, a town, by the way, one of the characters calls where snotty college kids live, because mm-hmm. Marlboro College is there. But I've seen features on this self-made house, this cabin that you have, living very simply with your tow-headed children, picking berries, you know, making scones at the market. It, in some ways, it looks like a very idyllic rural life.
Mm-hmm.
Is it close to these lives at all?
My life these days is pretty idyllic, and I feel like I was writing these stories from a place of empathy and what I saw and have seen and continue to see more than autobiography. Although, you know, the desire and the yearning, I think that has to be authentically personal for a writer to write about that in any way that feels rings true.
You mentioned your grandmother, and previously you and Tyler have come on to talk about the album that you made of songs that she collected, she mm-hmm. gathered, went out into the woods with her tape recorder in the mid-20th century, recording people, Vermont local folk people songs. And mm-hmm. I wondered if you're doing that in some way. Are you capturing this passage of time and life past mm-hmm. in rural Vermont?
Yeah. You know, I spent some time with my grandmother transcribing interviews from old Vermonters who she knew. And one of those interviews was somebody who lived in our town. And the people at the Vermont Folklife Center who had recorded the interview couldn't understand her accent. But because my grandmother knew her well, she could. And I was the one who knew how to operate the tape recorder because none of them did. So I grew up kind of doing that folkloric work with her and have always had a love for documentary work and capturing of voices that are not heard as often.
Well, congratulations. A beautifully well-done job on this one.
Thank you so much.
Robin MacArthur is an author and a musician. I spoke with her when her short story collection Half Wild was released this past summer. We're listening to Cold Lunettes. It's a song from the album Tigers of the New England Forest by her duo, Red Heart the Ticker. Robin will be reading along with Vermont's poet laureate Char de Noord at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, New Hampshire, tomorrow evening. That's Friday the 6th at 5:30. You'll find more information on the reading, the book, and the album at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today's 10-Minute Writers Workshop veers off the beaten path of literary fiction, nonfiction, and genre writers. Fitting in this case for a guy who has perfected his craft writing about rugged, versatile pieces, understated but substantial, and clothing that makes the jump from sidewalk to summit. That would be Jeffrey Ryan, who for many years wrote blurbs and product descriptions for the venerable L.L. Bean catalog. So how do they do it? They put a pair of duck boots in front of you and say, write these up, so someone's got to have them. Where do you begin?
There are so many places to begin, and that's one of the things with catalog writing is learning which angle to take, because there are so many of them that you can take. So for each product, you're primarily responsible for trying to figure out how to convey the primary use first, and then sort of weed out secondary uses and then throw the tertiary ones out of the mix because you don't have enough space.
Hmm.
Prioritizing is number one craft that you learn.
So do you imagine somebody wearing these, putting their feet into them, looking at them? How do you get the inspiration for that?
It's incredibly important to have some product knowledge, if at all possible. The best scenario is to hold the item in your hand, to have actually used it, or to, in fact, have been through the scenario of having a customer come and buy them from you. You really need to anticipate all the questions people ask because you have one chance to answer them again in a very small amount of space. So you're trying to accomplish a great many things when you set down a piece of copy. To get to your point, you really have to try to decide, is this about a revolutionary new lining in this boot? Is it about a classic construction method? Is it about the brand new sole that grips on snow and ice? What is that primary selling proposition? And everything else builds around that.
I was reading from the book about L.L. Bean. It was written by, I think, his grandson. It's called L.L. Bean, The Making of an American Icon. And he and his wife really basically did the writing for the first catalog. He said if the product had a good story, the chances were that it would be more successful than if it didn't have a good story. So how do you make up a story about mom jeans?
Basically, it comes back to the usage and what's credible and what's not. Bean had very much in their DNA telling the truth and not fabricating anything. You really have to put yourself in a credible position to talk about line jeans and say, why are they so great? Wearing jeans in the middle of the winter isn't always comfortable, but if you're going to wear them to the office or out in the barnyard or whatever you're using them for, this flannel lining adds an extra 5 degrees of warmth or whatever it may be. It's really important to me to have that credible piece behind it. That being said, it doesn't mean that you can't have fun with copy, and we certainly did from time to time when it was appropriate.
Yeah, any in-jokes that ever went into them or...
We had a slipper that was relatively nondescript. In fact, it was called Bean's Shearling Lined Slipper.
Woo!
And, you know, and again, Bean has a legacy of very plain, very simple, straightforward naming. They just didn't do all that well. And they asked me to go talk to the product manager and see if I could find something else about these slippers that made them special. And we talked for about 45 minutes. And finally, in a fit of exasperation, he said, I don't know what to tell you about these slippers. They're wicked good. And the light bulb went on in my head. And I said, that's it. We have the new name for the slipper. And now it's a staple of the company. And partially, well, I think a great deal of it has to do with the story that something in Maine, when it's called Wicked Good, it doesn't get any better than that. And the rest was history.
So do you get a portion of sales for every pair of Wicked Good slipper?
I wish. I get to tell you the story.
Is there any line, though, that you do remember that, oh, that was the best thing I ever did in a catalog? Was that it?
Headlines was sort of a forte that I had. I have an ability to come up with turns of phrases very well. And Bean's book pack, Tougher Than School, is one that that sticks, that everyone seems to remember that I came up with. It's partly being quick-witted and creative and partly being factual, and it's a great sort of marble cake of the two.
How did you get into this line of work?
I, in some ways, thought I was born to write the Yellow Bean catalog. My mother always used to tell me that when I was 12 and she asked me what I wanted to do when I was older, I actually told her I wanted to write the Yellow Bean catalog, which she was expecting astronaut or doctor or something. But I actually went to work at Bean in 1980, and I worked in the warehouse and in the camping department, among other things, for 7 years while I was trying to convince them that this was my calling. And in fact, I got a job in the department next door, and the two women that were largely responsible for writing the copy at the time were bouncing ideas over the wall to each other. And I think about 2 days into it, I couldn't take it anymore and started yelling ideas over the wall. And they went to their boss and said, we don't know who this guy over the wall is, but you need to go talk to him. The next thing I knew, I was actually writing a fly fishing catalog. Perseverance paid off.
So you didn't really ever aspire to like J. Peterman. It was always L.L. Bean.
Well, I sort of thought that was the best place to start. It was a big thing when I was young for the L.L. Bean catalog to arrive. It's hard, I imagine, for some listeners to imagine a time when the catalog was not one of many hundreds that arrived in the mailbox, but I recognized that there was a real quality to the stories being told and the way they were told, and I felt like I had an ability to do that.
So if you were to advise somebody who was thinking about, like, I would love to be a catalog writer, it's a great way to make a living, and of course now it's probably writing for online copy, what would you suggest is the way to approach it?
Well, I think actually I would try to pick up some items and have really disparate items, some that you know a lot about and some that you know nothing about, and try to figure out what the story would be. If you were trying to sell a pair of headphones or goat milk soap or a serrated knife, how would you go about selling every one of those things? And I think what I have found is that it's really much easier to sell things that are function-driven and very difficult and subjective to write about things that are decorative, because a lot of times people either like them or they don't. It's a real challenge to try to write about things like decorative wreaths or Hummel figurines. It's a really great way to test your ability and make yourself stretch. But I would start there. How do I describe these? And if I was the consumer on the other end, what would I want to know about them?
I'm curious, have you ever taken advantage of L.L. Bean's lifetime guarantee, Jeff?
I think I had a pair of boots resold. I hesitate to say this, but I was in the position to have had a pair of perfect 9 medium feet. So I was asked to product test footwear a lot. So I didn't have to take advantage of the guarantee too much.
Wicked good advice, Jeff. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Jeffrey Ryan there, author of Appalachian Odyssey, a 28-year hike on America's Trail. He's a former writer for the L.L. Bean catalog and just one of many who share their creative process for the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Google Play. And we're out of time for today. Thanks so much for listening. Music in this episode came to us from David Seste, Poddington Bear, and Blue Dot Sessions. Loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org or on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio, or on Twitter at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.